Gandhi's autobiography isn't merely a historical account. It's a spiritual odyssey that has inspired millions worldwide. When Martin Luther King Jr. traveled to India in 1959, he declared, "To other countries, I may go as a tourist, but to India, I come as a pilgrim." King wasn't alone in finding inspiration in Gandhi's life story. Nelson Mandela, the Dalai Lama, and countless others have drawn strength from this remarkable narrative of personal transformation. First published in 1927, this Story of My Experiments with Truth remains one of the most influential autobiographies ever written, offering timeless wisdom on moral courage, spiritual growth, and the power of nonviolent resistance. Born in 1869 to a family of the merchant Banya caste in Porbandar, Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi emerged from a lineage that had served as prime ministers in Kathiawad states for three generations. His father, Karamchand Gandhi, was known for his unwavering truthfulness and courage, once refusing to apologize to a British agent despite detention. His deeply religious mother, Putlibai, maintained the strictest religious vows without complaint, even during illness. Young Mohandas was a painfully shy, academically mediocre student who rushed home immediately after classes. Two childhood experiences profoundly shaped his moral development: reading about Shravana's devotion to his parents and watching a play about King Harishchandra's unwavering commitment to truth. These stories moved him deeply, and he would repeatedly act out Harishchandra's trials, wondering why everyone couldn't be equally truthful. At 13, Gandhi was married to Kasturbai in a triple wedding arranged alongside his brothers' and cousins' marriages. Like most Hindu marriages of the time, it involved elaborate preparations that often financially ruined families. As a child, Gandhi viewed the event merely as an opportunity for new clothes, processions, and rich food. Though he would later criticize child marriage, at the time, everything seemed proper to him. "That first night," he writes, "two innocent children were thrust into the ocean of life together, both of us too nervous and shy to face each other, though I quickly assumed the authority of a husband." His early relationship with Kasturbai was marked by jealousy and conflict. Influenced by marriage pamphlets that emphasized lifelong fidelity, he converted his wife's duty into his right to demand faithfulness. He restricted her movements, requiring his permission for her to go anywhere, which sparked bitter quarrels. Yet their relationship wasn't one of unrelieved bitterness. His strictness stemmed from love and a desire to make her his ideal wife. Despite his wish to educate her, lustful love and the constraints of Kathiawad's purdah system prevented meaningful instruction. Gandhi's moral development was tested repeatedly during his youth. At 15, he committed a serious theft, cutting gold from his brother's armlet to pay a debt. Overwhelmed with guilt, he wrote a confession to his bedridden father, asking for punishment and promising never to steal again. When his father read it, tears streamed down his face before he tore up the note. This moment of pure forgiveness transformed Gandhi, increasing his father's affection for him beyond measure. During his 16th year, while nursing his father, who was bedridden with a fistula, Gandhi experienced what he called his double shame. Despite his duties as his father's caretaker, he was consumed by carnal desire for his pregnant wife. On the night of his father's death, he eagerly left his nursing duties when his uncle offered to relieve him, only to be called back minutes later when his father passed away. "I've never forgiven myself for this double shame," he writes, "yielding to lust during my wife's pregnancy and missing my father's final moments when I should have been by his side." After struggling academically in Kathiawad, Gandhi was encouraged to study law in England, a prospect that thrilled him as he was finding his studies difficult. His family had concerns about the moral dangers of England, so to address his mother's fears about meat-eating, drinking, and moral corruption, he took solemn vows before a Jain monk not to touch wine, women, or meat. His caste, however, declared him an outcast for planning to cross the ocean, threatening to fine anyone who helped him. This only strengthened his resolve. In London, Gandhi's shyness and vegetarianism initially isolated him. He attempted to transform himself into an English gentleman, spending money on fashionable clothes, dancing lessons, and violin instruction. "I wasted 19 shillings on a chimney pot hat," he confesses, "and 10 pounds on a Bond Street evening suit." Eventually, he recognized the folly of these efforts and focused on his studies instead. His commitment to vegetarianism deepened when he discovered Salt's plea for vegetarianism, which transformed his reluctant dietary practice into a principled choice and lifelong mission. He joined the Vegetarian Society, became part of its executive committee, and even started his own vegetarian club. These experiences planted seeds for his later, more strenuous dietary experiments. In 1893, Gandhi accepted work in South Africa, where he would experience the racial discrimination that would transform his life and philosophy. Upon arrival in Durban, he immediately noticed the disrespect shown to Indians. His distinctive dress, a frock coat and turban, marked him as different, and he faced his first direct confrontation with racism when a magistrate demanded he remove his turban in court, which he refused to do. His journey to Pretoria became a series of humiliations that awakened him to the plight of Indians in South Africa. At Maritzburg, he was forcibly removed from a first-class train compartment despite having a valid ticket. Left in an unlit waiting room in the bitter winter cold, he contemplated his duty. Should he fight for his rights, return to India, or continue his journey despite the insults? He decided it would be cowardly to abandon his obligation and resolved to continue to Pretoria, seeking redress only to the extent necessary to combat color prejudice. At Charlestown, the coach agent seated him outside rather than with white passengers. At Partakoff, the situation worsened when the leader demanded Gandhi sit on dirty sackcloth at his feet. When Gandhi refused this degradation, the man violently boxed his ears and tried to drag him down. Gandhi clung desperately to the brass rails as he was beaten, until some passengers intervened saying he was right. These experiences crystallized Gandhi's understanding of the systemic injustice faced by Indians in South Africa. He began organizing the Indian community, forming the Natal Indian Congress in 1894. His approach was unique. He combined political activism with personal service, living modestly and often performing menial tasks himself. When plague broke out in the Indian location near Johannesburg, Gandhi personally nursed the sick, cleaned latrines, and organized sanitation efforts. His legal work increasingly focused on serving the community rather than personal gain. He charged modest fees and often worked pro bono. His reputation for honesty grew when he once asked a magistrate to dismiss his own client's case after discovering the client had deceived him. Rather than damaging his practice, this enhanced his standing, earning him unbounded affection and trust from the Indian community. The pivotal moment in Gandhi's development came in 1906 when the Transvaal government introduced legislation requiring all Indians to register and provide fingerprints. This Black Act sparked Gandhi's first organized resistance campaign, which he initially called Passive Resistance, but later renamed Satyagraha, Truth Force. "I offered a prize through Indian opinion for the best suggestion," Gandhi writes. "Moganlal Gandhi coined Satyagraha, Truth Firmness, which I modified to Satyagraha. This term became the designation for our struggle." The campaign demonstrated Gandhi's evolving approach to resistance. He insisted on maintaining respect for opponents while firmly refusing to comply with unjust laws. When Indians were imprisoned for their resistance, Gandhi encouraged them to accept punishment willingly rather than evade it. This approach confused authorities who were accustomed to dealing with violent opposition. During this period, Gandhi established two communal living experiments, Phoenix Settlement near Durban in 1904 and Tolstoy Farm near Johannesburg in 1910. These communities became laboratories for his evolving philosophy, combining manual labor, simple living, and spiritual practice. At Phoenix, residents produced their own food, built their own houses, and published the newspaper Indian Opinion. At Tolstoy Farm, Gandhi deepened his experiments with diet, fasting, and brahmacharya, celibacy. Gandhi's personal transformation accelerated during this time. In 1906, he took a vow of brahmacharya, complete sexual abstinence, believing that procreation was inconsistent with public service. I realized that a person who wanted to devote himself to service could not do so without taking the vow of brahmacharya, he explains. With his wife's consent, he took the vow, which he maintained for the rest of his life. His dietary experiments also intensified. He adopted a fruit diet, eliminated salt and pulses, and eventually gave up milk products. These weren't merely health practices, but spiritual disciplines aimed at controlling sensual desires. I considered my body to be a temple of the spirit, he writes, and therefore felt the need to keep it pure from within and without. After 21 years in South Africa, Gandhi returned to India in 1915, already famous for his work, but still developing his approach to Indian independence. Gokhale advised him to spend a year traveling and observing before expressing opinions on Indian matters. Gandhi established the Satyagraha Ashram in Ahmedabad, where he immediately challenged orthodox Hindu practice by accepting an untouchable family. When financial supporters withdrew in protest, Gandhi resolved to move to the untouchables' quarter if necessary, living by manual labor. Providentially, an anonymous donor provided $13,000 the next day. Gandhi's first significant Indian satyagraha came in Champaran, Bihar in 1917, where indigo planters forced tenants to grow indigo on a portion of their land, the Tinkathia system. After being arrested for investigating tenant complaints and refusing to leave the district, Gandhi demonstrated the power of civil disobedience. The authorities, confused by his willingness to accept punishment while maintaining respect for them, withdrew the case. The subsequent inquiry led to abolition of the exploitative system. In meeting these peasants, Gandhi writes, I found myself face to face with God, ahimsa, and truth. A realization stemming from nothing but my love for the people and unshakable faith in nonviolence. Gandhi followed this success with satyagraha campaigns in Kedah, where peasants struggled with crop failure and excessive revenue demands, and in Ahmedabad, where he supported mill workers in a labor dispute. During the Ahmedabad strike, he undertook his first political fast when workers began to waver, declaring he would fast until they either reached a settlement or left the mills altogether. A critical development in Gandhi's work was his revival of hand spinning and weaving. After extensive searching, Ganga Behen Majmundar discovered spinning wheels in Vijapur that had been abandoned as useless lumber. Gandhi convinced villagers to resume spinning, providing them with cotton and purchasing their yarn. At the ashram, Maganlal Gandhi made mechanical improvements to the spinning wheel. The first khadi, hand-spun cloth, manufactured at the ashram cost 17 annas per yard, expensive but symbolically important. I described the handloom and spinning wheel in Hind Swaraj as the solution to India's poverty, Gandhi writes, though I had never actually seen either until years later. This initiative would eventually become a cornerstone of his economic program and a powerful symbol of Indian self-reliance. By 1920, Gandhi had emerged as a national leader, combining the Khilafat movement, supporting the Ottoman Caliphate, with his own non-cooperation campaign. Despite skepticism from some Congress leaders, the non-cooperation resolution passed unanimously at the Nagpur Congress session. The movement called for boycotting British institutions, courts, and educational systems while promoting Swadeshi, indigenous goods. Gandhi's approach to leadership was unique. Despite his growing stature, he maintained his simple lifestyle and continued his experiments with truth. He traveled third class on trains, experiencing the hardships faced by ordinary Indians. The railway authorities treat third class passengers like sheep, he observed, and fellow passengers display both rudeness and selfishness. His insistence on Hindu-Muslim unity was central to his vision. When some suggested coupling the Khilafat issue with cow protection, Gandhi objected. If the Khilafat cause is just, which I believe it is, Hindus are duty-bound to support Muslims regardless of the cow question. It would be improper to use the occasion to make terms. Gandhi's leadership style emphasized personal example over mere rhetoric. During the Rowlatt Act protests in 1919, he called for a nationwide hartal, suspension of business, combined with fasting and prayer. The response was overwhelming. All of India, towns and villages alike, observed a complete hartal. It was a most wonderful spectacle, he recalls. However, when violence erupted in some places, Gandhi immediately suspended the campaign, calling it his Himalayan miscalculation. He realized that before people could practice civil disobedience, they needed to understand and demonstrate the discipline of nonviolence. I had failed to observe this limitation, he admits, calling people to civil disobedience before they were qualified. This willingness to acknowledge mistakes and adjust course became a hallmark of Gandhi's leadership. He launched the newspapers Young India and Navajivan to educate the public about Satyagraha's principles, refusing advertisements to maintain their independence. Through these journals, he developed a direct relationship with readers across India, explaining his evolving philosophy and responding to current events. Throughout his autobiography, Gandhi emphasizes that his political work was inseparable from his spiritual journey. Politics became unavoidable in my devotion to truth, he writes. Those claiming religion has nothing to do with politics misunderstand religion itself. This integration of spirituality and political action became the cornerstone of his revolutionary approach to social change, influencing movements worldwide. His understanding of truth evolved from conventional honesty to a profound spiritual principle. There is no God but truth, he declares, with ahimsa, nonviolence, as the only path to its realization. This wasn't passive non-resistance, but active love, even toward opponents. During the Punjab investigations after the Jallianwala Bagh massacre, Gandhi refused to demonize British officials despite their brutal actions. He maintained this stance even when faced with severe persecution, demonstrating that nonviolence required greater courage than violent resistance. His response to the Chari Chara incident, where he suspended the non-cooperation movement after violence erupted, exemplified this unwavering commitment to nonviolence. Self-purification remains central to his approach, manifesting through rigorous personal disciplines. His various vows and dietary experiments weren't merely personal quirks, but deliberate attempts to discipline his body and mind. When he broke his vow against milk by accepting goat's milk during a serious illness, he felt deep remorse. "I killed the soul of my vow while adhering to its letter." His fasts, which often lasted weeks, were not just political tools, but spiritual exercises in self-control and moral authority. He maintained detailed journals of his dietary experiments, viewing the body as a temple that required careful maintenance for spiritual growth. Gandhi's religious outlook was remarkably inclusive, far ahead of his time. Though born Hindu, he studied Christianity, Islam, and other faiths deeply, finding universal truths in each tradition. In London, he read the Bible, finding the Sermon on the Mount particularly moving, often comparing its teachings of love and forgiveness to Hindu concepts. He attempted to unify these teachings with the Bhagavad Gita, drawn to the concept of renunciation as religion's highest form. The Gita became his infallible guide of conduct, his dictionary of daily reference. He regularly held interfaith prayer meetings where texts from various religions were recited, demonstrating practical religious harmony. His experiments with communal living at Phoenix, Tolstoy Farm, and Sabarmati Ashram were attempts to create microcosms of his ideal society. These communities emphasized manual labor, simple living, religious tolerance, and service to others. Education at these ashrams focused on character development rather than mere literacy, with teachers working alongside students in all tasks. The ashrams practiced radical equality, breaking caste barriers by having all members, regardless of background, participate in cleaning toilets and other menial tasks. Daily routines included prayer meetings, spinning khadi, agricultural work, and community service, creating a model of self-sufficient, harmonious living that challenged both British imperialism and traditional Indian social hierarchies. Gandhi concludes his autobiography in 1921 during a pivotal moment when his deepening involvement with Congress politics and the independence movement made it increasingly complex to discuss relationships with living colleagues. By this point, he had established himself as India's foremost leader, though the independence struggle would continue for another 26 years through campaigns like the Salt March, Quit India movement, and the challenging period of partition negotiations. The narrative ends with a characteristically humble assessment of his achievements. "My glimpses of truth are but the faintest glimmers of its indescribable brilliance. Despite decades of rigorous spiritual practice, including daily meditation, fasting, and adherence to his 11 vows, he acknowledges his continuing struggle for self-purification. Despite constant striving, I lack triple purity in thought, speech, and action." This admission reveals Gandhi's understanding that spiritual growth is not a destination, but an endless journey of refinement. His final words capture both his deepest spiritual aspiration and his profound recognition of how far he still had to travel. "I must reduce myself to zero, for without placing oneself last among fellow creatures, there is no salvation. Ahimsa represents the farthest limit of humility. I ask you to join me in prayer that God grant me ahimsa in mind, word, and deed." This conclusion exemplifies his belief that true leadership emerges from selfless service and complete humility. Gandhi's autobiography stands as one of history's most remarkable documents of spiritual and political transformation. From a shy, ordinary lawyer in South Africa who once struggled to speak in court, to the Mahatma who would lead India's masses to independence, his journey demonstrates how personal integrity and moral conviction can become a powerful force for social change. His experiments with truth continue to inspire generations of activists and leaders, from Martin Luther King Jr. to Nelson Mandela, showing how nonviolent action and moral courage can transform societies. What makes Gandhi's story so compelling is not that he was born extraordinary, but that he made himself so through relentless self-examination and principled action. He transformed his personal weaknesses, his shyness, his fears, his early prejudices, into stepping stones toward greater understanding and strength. As he wrote, "My uniform experience has convinced me that there is no other God than truth." This conviction led him to constantly question his assumptions, admit his mistakes publicly, and revise his methods based on experience. His life remains testimony to the power of that conviction, showing how one person's dedication to truth and nonviolence can catalyze massive social change while maintaining the highest ethical standards. The autobiography's unfinished nature itself serves as a powerful metaphor for Gandhi's philosophy, that the pursuit of truth and self-improvement is a continuous journey that never reaches a final destination. His legacy continues to influence movements for social justice, environmental protection, and peaceful conflict resolution worldwide, proving that his experiments with truth were not just personal, but universal in their application and impact. What ultimately distinguishes Gandhi's autobiography is its radical honesty and unflinching self-examination. Unlike many leaders who present carefully curated versions of themselves, Gandhi deliberately exposes his deepest flaws, moral failures, and ongoing internal battles. He details his youthful theft of gold from his brother, his controlling and jealous treatment of his wife Kasturba, his struggles as an often absent father to his four sons, and his moments of cowardice and compromise in the face of British authority. These admissions are particularly striking given his eventual status as a revered spiritual and political leader. He describes how his early attempts at organizing resistance in South Africa were marked by uncertainty and tactical mistakes. He openly discusses his experiments with diet, sexuality, and religious practice, many of which drew criticism or proved unsuccessful. Rather than diminishing his stature, this transparency about his imperfections makes his transformation all the more remarkable and relatable. Through this candid self-examination, we witness the gradual metamorphosis of an ordinary man into a moral giant. Gandhi's greatness lies not in natural perfection, but in his relentless efforts toward self-improvement. His willingness to acknowledge error, adjust course, and continue experimenting with truth despite repeated setbacks and failures. Each mistake becomes a stepping stone toward greater understanding and ethical refinement. His journey illuminates a crucial truth about moral leadership. It doesn't require extraordinary beginnings, but rather an extraordinary commitment to growth and service. Gandhi's early life as a shy lawyer who could barely speak in court provides hope that character can be developed through consistent effort. His evolution from a British-educated barrister in a three-piece suit to a dhoti-wearing champion of the masses demonstrates how radical personal transformation is possible through dedicated practice. In a world still plagued by violence, injustice, and division, Gandhi's experiments with truth offer not just inspiration, but practical guidance. His methods of introspection, his commitment to nonviolence even in the face of brutality, and his integration of political action with spiritual practice provide a roadmap for anyone seeking to align their inner convictions with their outer actions. His famous directive to be the change you wish to see in the world is not mere rhetoric, but a tested formula for personal and social transformation proven through his own journey from ordinary to extraordinary.